The next case is 04-737, Amanda Galland et al. Versus Meridia Health Systems. Mr. Sullivan.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please.
Your time.
May it please the court, my name is Brian Sullivan. I have the pleasure of representing Meridia Health Systems in this appeal this morning. The issue presented by this case is whether Ohio law recognizes a claim for the negligent infliction of emotional distress when the distress is caused by the plaintiff's fear of a non-existent physical peril.
Let's stop you there. Is that the issue? I thought it seemed to me that the issue that the Court of Appeals decided paragraph 15 of its decision is this court finds the trial court abused its discretion by prematurely ruling on Appellee's motion for partial summary judgment without first granting appellant's motion for continuance to complete discovery. Isn't that the legal issue before us?
The issue that was presented by way of the jurisdictional memorandums that was framed in terms of that issue, which presents great public interest or public import, is the issue over whether or not Ohio law should recognize a claim for the negligent infliction of emotional distress arising out of the fear of a non-physical peril.
Well, but perhaps the motion for cert didn't tell us what the real. I mean, if the Court of Appeals decides a case on one basis, and you tell us here's an important issue that we want you to decide, but it's not what the Court of Appeals decided, what do we do in that situation?
Well, the Court of Appeals reached two issues in its decision. One of the assignments of error that was raised by the plaintiffs below is whether or not the trial court should have withheld ruling on the summary judgment motion and permitted the plaintiff additional time to do discovery. The second issue that was decided by the Court of Appeals was that additional discovery may be appropriate because because the plaintiff had sustained a contemporaneous physical injury, she could maintain a claim for the fear, for the emotional distress arising out of fear caused by a non-physical peril. We submitted to the trial court that there was no additional discovery which the plaintiff could possibly have obtained to address the legal issue over whether or not Ohio law should recognize a claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress, again, arising out of the plaintiff's fear of a non-existent physical peril. So we would submit that the legal issue before the court is whether or not, in fact, Ohio law should permit a plaintiff to be able to seek redress for a claim.
Well, you reach a conclusion. A non-existent what?
Physical peril. That is the language that's been used by this court in the Heiner versus Mortuzzi decision, and more recently in the Dobrin versus Franciscan Medical Center decision, where this court specifically stated.
The Court of Appeals distinguished Heiner, and they I agree with the chief. They don't seem to be where you framed this at all, in terms of their decision. What you want to have us decide seems to be an academic exercise at this point. The case isn't to that point.
Well, the Court of Appeals did distinguish this court's precedents in Heiner, and it did so based upon its interpretation of the Binns decision, and concluded that in light of the fact that plaintiff had sustained a contemporaneous physical injury, in this case a puncture wound from a suture needle, that Ohio law permitted her at that point to maintain a claim for the negligent infliction of emotional distress arising out of the fear that she might someday contract AIDS or the HIV virus. And we would submit that is incorrect, that the decision by the Court of Appeals contradicts this court's precedents, misinterprets previous precedents of this court in both the Schultz and the Pugh cases, which have developed the law as it relates to the maintenance of a claim for negligent infliction of emotional
and,
distress.
And the, well, I'm still back to the procedure. I'm having a hard time understanding why we shouldn't just say this case was improbably allowed.
There were two issues that were addressed in the Court of Appeals. One was the issue concerning discovery and whether or not the trial court should have either granted a motion to compel discovery that the plaintiff had filed or permitted the plaintiff additional time within which to develop evidence.
Well, and you treat that rather cavalierly. My reading of this is that the plaintiff was rebuffed every time they tried to get discovery. I mean, it seems to me you're not here with clean hands.
I would disagree with that characterization. In fact, the defendants did respond to both plaintiff's first set of discovery and plaintiff's second set of discovery. The contention was that the plaintiff was not satisfied with the scope of the responses permitted by defendants.
And the Court of Appeals agreed with them.
The Court of Appeals agreed that the trial court should have granted the plaintiffs additional time within which to develop evidence so that they could potentially support their claim. Our point is, however,
to develop evidence to get you to answer the interrogatories, your client.
Our point was, however, that no additional discovery would change the fact that Ohio law does not recognize a claim for the negligent infliction of emotional distress arising out of a plaintiff's fear of a non-existent physical peril.
So when you get punctured by a contaminated syringe, hypodermic needle, that's you then have concerns that are of a not about a non-existent physical peril.
In this case, the plaintiffs argued that in light of the puncture wound resulting from stepping on a suture needle that was left in the emergency room, that the plaintiff did develop a fear that she would subsequently contract the HIV virus. The evidence that was presented to the trial court, however, demonstrated that she had been tested repeatedly on four separate occasions, and that on each occasion she tested negative for the presence of the HIV virus. It's undisputed, the record is undisputed, that the plaintiff does not have HIV, did not test positive for HIV, and as a result, does not have a physical peril for which she has incurred fear.
Counsel, hypothetically, the other side did file the Rule 56F motion for additional discovery. Hypothetically, we certainly hope it doesn't happen, but a test could show a positive HIV. That would change your discussion here, would it not?
I would submit that as a legal matter, if in fact the plaintiff contracted AIDS, that we would, or the HIV virus, we would not be before this court with that issue. The issue raised by this appeal, based upon the state of the record and the undisputed evidence, is that the plaintiff does not have the HIV virus.
Although there was a statement in the record that said there is a time period where she may be at risk. So we're talking about a significant period of time where a manifestation may occur. And by cutting off the case early, by asking for a partial summary judgment on the fact that there is, as yet, no positive indication, we are, in a sense, not giving the plaintiff sufficient time to potentially show that there is a positive.
Well, I would submit, Justice Lanzinger, that the issue here is whether the plaintiff can maintain a claim for the fear that she has, that she will someday contract the HIV virus, not for the fact that she actually is positive for the HIV virus, but for the fear that she may contract the virus. And the evidence in regards to whether or not the plaintiff is HIV positive is solely within the domain of the plaintiff. The plaintiff need not do discovery on the defendants to establish the fact that she is or that she is not positive for the HIV virus. I don't believe additional time would shed any light or provide any evidence in relation to that critical element of their claim.
Mr. Sullivan, let me tell you what my problem is here. I'm suffering the burden of being concerned about process. And it seems to me if we adopt your view of this case on the procedural issue, that if there are two issues, the procedural issue, that we almost have to say that as a matter of law, that as a principle of law, that a trial judge who determines that the plaintiff's case has no merit may deny adequate time for discovery, for preparation of affidavits, for whatever affidavits discovery, to respond to a motion for summary judgment. Is that really what we want the law to be?
I would agree, Justice Moore, that would be problematic. But I would submit that that's not the facts of this case, and that's not the procedural history
of
this case.
We don't decide cases here on facts. We're supposed to be writing principles of law that can be applied in future cases. Here, one of the issues presented to us by the opinion of the Court of Appeals is that the trial court abused its discretion by not permitting one of the parties adequate time to present its case on a motion for summary judgment. Now, we have to decide that issue. In my view, we have to decide the issue one way or the other. We can improv it and say, we don't want to speak to this, or we have to speak to it. And somehow we have to write a principle of law that applies to other cases. You may be right ultimately on the facts and the law of this case, but I'm concerned about the process here. It appears to me that the trial judge simply decided this plaintiff can't win. And can't win, and so I'm not going to give the plaintiff the opportunity to gather more evidence on a motion for summary. It's a motion for summary judgment. I mean, it's a presumptive kind of point in the process, and that's why I'm concerned about it.
And I believe the trial court's decision was based upon the fact that the plaintiff could not win because they could not legally sustain a cause of action cognizable in the state of Ohio for the negligent infliction of emotional distress for fear arising out of a non-existent physical peril. No facts, no evidence that could be developed would change the legal significance of that claim.
You had shown that there was a positive and that it was not a non-existent fear.
Well, then I would submit that the claim would not be the negligent infliction of emotional distress for the fear of contracting HIV, but they would have a bodily injury claim or a negligence claim arising out of the fact that they were, in fact, HIV positive. The essence of this claim is an infliction claim, a negligent infliction claim, arising out of a fear of something that they haven't contracted. And this court was concerned with opening up a Pandora's box and permitting these types of claims when it spoke in the issue in both Heiner and Dobrin. If the court were to permit such a claim, I would suggest that it's a slippery slope. Then is an individual who works in a factory and is exposed to asbestos fibers, do they have a claim for the negligent infliction of emotional distress because they may contract asbestos? Is a child who receives a vaccine have a claim that they potentially may come down with autism because there's arguably a statistical link between childhood vaccinations and autism? For fear of catching a cold because somebody sneezes on them.
Did you file a motion for judgment on the pleadings?
Yes. In fact, a motion for judgment was on the pleadings, and that was denied by the trial court and deferred to pending filing motions of summary judgment. Okay. I see that I've used most of my time. I would like to save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you.
Mr. Mixell.
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. William Mixell for the appellee. Perhaps I can sort out some of the misunderstandings regarding the procedural issue, the 56F motion. That was predicated on the basis of a question, an interrogatory that I had asked, asking the defendant to list everyone that was in the emergency room that night. My purpose, of course, was to ultimately depose those and seek the facts from any other people that were in there. The response from the defendant was they listed the physician and two of the attending nurses, and there said others yet to be determined will be supplemented.
Okay, you were looking to see if there was anybody treated in the emergency room who was HIV positive.
No, Your Honor. I was attempting to find out if there were any other witnesses to the event. And that was the substance of the 56F. I didn't get that information. As the record will show, several bits of correspondence, both written and telephone, motions, et cetera, et cetera. We have finally resolved that issue.
Well, counsel, we seem to have a big dispute over whether we had to have further discovery to reach the basic issue of whether you even had a cause of action. What further discovery would have changed the fact? I mean, we have a legal issue as to whether simply a fear allows it. You obviously want us to rule that a simple fear without proof that it actually has happened yet is sufficient, correct? That's what you want us to find.
That's partially correct, Your Honor, but it goes a little beyond that. Let me step back for a second. When we were attempting to discover who was present, I would agree with the trial court in part that, as it turns out, maybe or maybe not, I don't know if there would have been additional, if there would have been some additional facts discovered. I don't know that. The essence of the case here, and the essence, and as the trial court, when it addressed the partial summary, motion for summary judgment, specifically relied on the Heiner case. It says so in its order. Basically says the Heiner case is controlling and you lose. I respectfully submit, as the Court of Appeals agreed, that the Heiner case is clearly distinguishable on the facts.
So don't we really have to decide whether on this type of a fact pattern you have a cause of action for a non-existing peril, but the fear still exists? Don't we have to decide if you have a cause of action for that to decide whether any further evidence?
I would respectfully disagree that the peril does in fact exist. And I say that because, as the record will reflect, the defendant's case in total defense is that this 5.5-year-old little gal did not contract HIV, and they offer as evidence of that 3 blood tests that all turned out to be negative over a 6-month period.
And what is your evidence that she can or will?
Our evidence is that, A, the tests by their own admission are not 100% accurate. In fact, the information sheet that they were given at the time that they agreed to the testing clearly points out that these tests are not 100% accurate, and there are often false positives. And I would point you to the Heiner case.
Okay, then did you have any contravailing evidence that you were prevented from presenting that showed she is in fact positive? Did you have any tests that came up differently?
I do not.
Well, you didn't even have the needle. The needle was disposed of.
The needle was never recovered. We know the needle existed. We know the attending nurse had the needle. On deposition, I asked her.
And you were never provided the names of all of the people, patients that were in that room. You had two of them.
The facts, Justice Resnick, is that they never tested the needle. They never, in fact, recovered the needle. When I asked on deposition the nurse if anyone went through the records of the people that were treated in the OR prior to determine whether or not those folks could be brought in and tested, their response was it would be too much trouble. So,
Mr. Mixell, let me ask you, is there some reason that you didn't brief the other issue, the issue that I let Mr. Sullivan have a lot of time to answer?
Well, Your Honor, I share...
You're not concerned about the fact now, I guess, that you and the Court of Appeals said you should have more time, you should have been given more time for discovery, but you don't mention that. At least if you did, I missed it.
No, Your Honor, you're correct.
Is
I did not.
Is that because it doesn't matter now? Or
if your question is that an issue? It is not. I have discovered... We have since worked that out, and, you know, I'm confident there was nobody else in the OR at that time. I don't think that's an issue from a factual standpoint.
So you're...
Why was it an issue? I mean, if I can just follow up, why was it an issue in the Court of Appeals opinion and not an issue now? Has something happened in between the time the Court of Appeals rendered this decision and when we're hearing the case?
Yes, something did happen, Your Honor.
If it's outside the record, we don't need to hear it, but...
I had correspondence, and I, in fact, withdrew our motion to compel. That was the basis for that. So we did work out the procedural issues. I think, in all candor, we got off on the case on the merits based on Heiner.
If I can understand your argument, you're really not arguing that this is a non-existent peril. You're saying that's not really the legal issue. You're saying this is an existing peril. We're seeking to recover from an existing peril, and we just weren't given the opportunity to prove the statistical value of the fact she may or whatever. We weren't given the opportunity to prove that it is an existing peril. Is that what you're arguing? Or are you still saying that even if you couldn't prove it was an existing peril that she had HIV, you should still recover because she has this fear she may get it someday?
There is a distinction between the risk of contracting a disease and the fear of contracting this disease. And our position is that because the testing that was done by the defendant, by the way, because those tests were negative, doesn't in and of itself preclude the possibility that Amanda Gallen will not at some future time contract HIV as a direct and proximate result of her exposure.
So whether it's a 1% risk or an 80% risk is immaterial in your theory. Your theory is because there is some risk in the future, she has a legitimate fear and should recover.
That's correct, Your Honor. It exists.
Are you concerned about the risk of contracting it or the fear of contracting it?
I'm concerned about the fear of contracting.
Are there cases that you can cite to us where the fear of contracting a disease have been compensable?
I can cite you to a Cuyahoga County case.
Pardon me, please.
Lavelle versus Owens Corning. In that case, that was an asbestos case.
Yes.
I don't know what you're talking about. And that issue arose out of some motions in limine. And the court basically said, you can go forward on the fear of contracting asbestosis, but you cannot go forward on the risk because there was no evidence.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Counsel, if the fear is not in any way proportional to the risk, you're saying at that point it's up to the jury to decide the reasonableness of the fear given the circumstances and the evidence that will be presented?
That is absolutely correct.
All right. But in your mind, you would argue to the jury there's no proportional test that needs to be met. It's just the existence, as was stated, either 1% or 99%. Doesn't matter. The fear is real, and you've got to convince a jury.
Because there is no real conflict here. These tests are not 100% accurate. And even if there was a scintilla of possibility that she could contract HIV, that scintilla, or as the defendant would say, the overwhelming probability that she will not, but that still in and of itself doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And that should be a question for the jury, as to use your term, which is correct, reasonable. Was that a reasonable fear under the circumstances? We submit that it was.
So we really have to decide whether that fear alone, regardless of the risk factor, is a legal theory on which you can recover before any further evidence even matters, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
But so our syllabus in Heiner says, Ohio does not recognize a claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress where it is caused by the plaintiff's fear of a non-existent physical peril. Mr. Sullivan's arguing, of course, she doesn't have it. Or the best evidence we have is she doesn't have it. And you don't have any evidence that she might get it.
Just so now,
I think that's my problem with
right.
this.
When you look at the Heiner case, as the Court of Appeals so ruled, it is distinguished on its facts. Heiner arose out of a situation where a woman who wanted to become pregnant through in vitro, it was her own blood that was tested. Obviously, she had no risk. This is contrary to the facts in this case, where the blood that my client was exposed to
she stepped
is
on
unknown
the needle.
To this day. So I analogize that issue. If a person points a gun at your head, you would experience a certain amount of stress and fear. It is of no moment to you later on when you find out that the gun was unloaded. You have still expressed that fear and that apprehension. And Amanda Gallen and
Well, Counsel, in your example there was a certainty there as to the reality of the danger. The gun was unloaded. And at this point, what you're arguing is that it will be forever unknown whether there's a risk, whether she will contract HIV because of the inaccuracy of the test is your argument here. And in Heiner, they knew that the fear did not, or that the risk, the condition that was feared never materialized. Okay? Now, jumping ahead to Dobrin, what would your...
Dobrin was similar on his facts. The situation...
Similar to your facts here.
No. In essence, what happened in Dobrin is similar in facts as what happened to in Heiner. In Dobrin, what they did was they lost
I'm familiar with Dobrin.
Okay. They lost a sample that would have perhaps contributed to knowing whether or not he was going to be 100% cancer-free. But that's different than the facts in my case.
Wait a minute. That was never known then. That tissue was unrecoverable. There was always the question mark over that, okay?
Right. But the underlying reason Mr. Dobrin was being tested had nothing to do with the defendant. He contracted cancer as a natural thing. And in Heiner, it was Heiner's own blood that she ultimately, and incidentally, in Heiner, that blood was tested twice by the Red Cross, and who knows more about blood than it, and they tested it twice wrong. So the underlying basis of the claim in both Heiner and Dobrin had nothing to do with the defendant, but in this case, it did. It was the defendant's negligence that caused my client to become infected or possibly.
You're saying Dobrin had nothing to do with the defendant?
No, I'm saying the underlying basis for Dobrin's problem, his cancer, had nothing to do he contracted cancer. It was kind of like a misdiagnosis case in a way. But the difference, I think, is factually significant. In Heiner, it was a misdiagnosis case, and they found out, well, you know, we made a mistake. In Dobrin, they lost the tissue sample, but they had done several other tests, which under some circumstances would be considered enough. And
so what you're arguing here is the sufficiency of an HIV test at the state of the art.
That's exactly right. I'm saying that the defendant's position that this woman has a non-existing, her fear is from a non-existing peril, fails because the basis upon which the testing that they are relying on is not 100% accurate, and they admit that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mixell. Mr. Sullivan, you saved a minute and a half of your time.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would submit that the law does not deal in possibilities, and what the plaintiff is suggesting is that this court should recognize a cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress for the fear of the possibility of contracting a disease. And I would submit that if this court were to allow that argument, a Pandora's box would be opened, and there would be no stopping the types of claims for which plaintiffs would seek redress. The fact of the matter is, this court in Heiner, and again in Dobrin, has clearly articulated the fact that a fear must arise from a physical peril. We do not have that in this case, and as a result, I would submit that the Court of Appeals erred in concluding that the plaintiff could maintain their claim. I would ask this court to reverse that determination and enter judgment in favor of defendant.
Counsel, would your situation change listening to what your co-counsel has said here regarding the accuracy of an HIV test? If the needle itself had been examined and there was contaminated blood in that syringe?
It would not change my argument, Your Honor. I don't deny the existence of a potential risk to the plaintiff that somewhere in the future this disease may develop. I would submit that the evidence before the trial court, based upon the testimony that was the testimony of the plaintiffs, that they were informed from the doctor, is that the latency period for a disease of this sort is somewhere between 7 and 10 years. So I would submit that that risk does exist. I don't deny the existence of that risk. Our position is that Ohio law does not recognize a cause of action for fear that you may contract that. That there needs to be a physical manifestation or an actual peril in order to give rise to a claim for negligent infliction arising out of that fear.
So at the very least, there would have had to have been one positive test, in your view?
Yes. Okay. And at that point, I don't think the claim is a claim for infliction for a fear, but it's a claim for the fact that I've now contracted the HIV virus as a result of this puncture wound.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise. You may be seated.